these Marxist rebels had a vision of the kingdom of God. It was based upon this proposition that men were once upon a time brothers one with another in some primitive Garden of Eden society, and that they were very good and social, and as Marx said, had not been alienated from their social essence until an institution emerged, which was property. Now, if it should be true that you and I are selfish, tend to take advantage of other people, and I think it's obvious that this is true about us, but if it should be true that our inclination to take advantage of other people is not something deep within us, but is just the corruption of an institution, what a simple thing is to get rid of the institution, and then we will all be good. So you have the idea that you get rid of the institution of property. Now, there are all kinds of mistakes in this presupposition, though I think there is a great deal of truth in the Marxist analysis of social life and of social conflict. But there are all kinds of difficulties. First of all, it isn't true that men's selfishness is caused by an institution. Secondly, it isn't true that economic power is the only form of power which might corrupt men. There's political power, priestly power, all kinds of power. And thirdly, it isn't even true that ownership is the only form of economic power, for the power of management, as these commissars in Russia now well know, is economic power. The right to hire and fire is economic power. So there were all kinds of curious mistakes here, and out of these mistakes grew this wonderful utopian, this wonderful, and I say, terrible utopian illusion that if you could only socialize all property, you'd be on the way toward an idyllic society in which each one would give according to his ability and state according to his needs. There's something really quite terrible about the fact that this dream, this illusory conception of human nature and of human society should have been introduced into our stream of history when we would have had, in any event, a great difficulty in coming to terms with each other in a technical society. And that this dream should have turned into such a nightmare. Professor Barrington Moore of Harvard has just written a book on Soviet politics in which he traces how this dream turns into a nightmare step by step. And the final ironic, it seems to me, culmination is in a speech of Stalin where he claims that modern Russia has achieved the vision of a perfectly harmonious society because here is now a tyrannical state which has destroyed all centers of power except its own, so that there can be no competitions and frictions of power underneath it, claiming that this tyrannical unity is the realization of the original dream, idyllic dream. These are rather terrible aspects of our spiritual situation. And we have to consider that this is a dream which does not merely exist in Russia, but that there are thousands and millions of workers and intellectuals who believe it, in Europe and even more in Asia. And one of the greatest problems we face is whether we can keep this dream from spreading and corrupting and confusing the mind, heart, and conscience of Asia. In other words, we might have come to terms with our social problem. As I say, the healthiest nations have found some kind of a compromise between the middle-class dream and the Marxist dream. If the Civil War hadn't been introduced, and what makes matters even worse is that the Civil War became localized in an international conflict. This is a little bit in a macrocosm like the Greek history and microcosm where Athens becomes the proponent of the democratic principles and Sparta of the tyrannical principle. So we, the most libertarian of all the democratic democracies, of the liberal democracies, represent the one great world power, and Russia, where this dream without qualification, as it has come into European socialism, is the other great center. It's neither here nor there, but I think it is worth remembering from the standpoint of ourselves as Americans that while we haven't done so badly in exercising the responsibilities proportioned to our power as America, that on the whole, it's not a good thing for the world that we should have as much power as we have today. For many reasons, including the fact that this great problem of freedom and order, of preserving flexibility in society and yet contriving community, is solved by us more simply than by any other nation on earth, because we have fortunate circumstances that no other nation has, and we're tempted to make the world believe that we've got the ideal solution for this problem.
There is, incidentally, no ideal solution. I have an idea that people will be debating about the problem of freedom and order and how much tiny you can superimpose upon the vast vitality of a civilization without destroying this vitality.
On the one hand, and how you can allow these vitalities free play without it degenerating into the freedom of the strong to exploit the weak. People will be discussing that for hundreds of years. This is the ultimate problem of the human community.
I'm not a specialist on this subject. I've got a little solution of my own by analogy. I say it must be something like this. The human community must be something like this organism of ours, which has all sorts of automatic processes in it. Not conscious planning.
Without these automatic processes, we would have an impossible brain. Suppose we'd have to think each time our heart beats. This would be a very inconvenient thing, too. We would forget. Let the possibility that we forget stand for the mistakes that bureaucrats make. We would forget, in any case, our head would be too big, if bureaucracy always is too big. On the other hand, against the people that think that you can just have a society live by automatic processes, it might be worth mentioning that the more the human organism develops, the more there is conscious contrivance in it, because we do think more than the animals do about what we ought to do and what we ought not to do. There is conscious contrivance in our actions. I think the human organism is a pretty good analogy of the way society ought to solve this problem. But we haven't solved it. We have allowed this awful civil war which broke out at the heart of Europe to become an international civil war. And now we stand in a position where we are not sure whether we can be saved. It is certainly not possible simply to establish community with the Russians on any basis. I'm afraid our world government people who would like to solve this problem in terms of constitutions are wrong. There's no possibility when there is complete mutual mistrust of bridging this mistrust by a constitutional device. Constitutions do not create communities, but perfect them once they have been created by mutual trust, which is lacking. Here is this deep and terrible chasm between two great sections of the human community, so that we don't know. While we were dreaming about an ideal society, we don't even know whether we can be as good as the Pax Romana, because the Pax Romana was one, and we are two. And this presents us with the horrible possibilities of another world war, which certainly is not inevitable, but not impossible either. This is the social, political, economic dimension of the world crisis in which we stand. But I don't want to speak only about this level. I suggested that every great crisis has another dimension, a cultural crisis. The way people think about life is challenged, as well as the way that they organize their community. Now, I think that despite the variety of our religions and irreligions, our religious and our secular culture, despite the very wide varieties of convictions between naturalism and idealism in secularism, that there has been one faith which has kept modern man going, which has been his essential religion. And that is as seriously challenged today as anything in his social arrangement. This faith could be simply put. We all believe that the frustrations of life, that the fragmentary character of human existence, that conflict in the human community, war, that poverty and injustice in the community, that all of these things will be progressively solved by the onward march of history itself. We have regarded historical progress as the solution to the very problem of human existence. Were we poor, we would be rich tomorrow. Were we subject to nature's caprices, we would conquer nature tomorrow, and we did that. Were we subject to wars and conflict, we were looking forward to the Parliament of Mankind and the Federation of the World. The process of history would solve these problems. We could conceive this in various terms.
There were those who felt that history was merely the extension of nature, that nature was pushing history up, as it were, that history was merely an extension of the evolutionary process in nature. There were the others who had a different idea, namely that history was the gradual conquest of mind over nature. Thomas Huxley had it as against Darwin, for instance, and Spencer. At any rate, we were moving onward and upward forever. Sometimes we had our primary confidence, as the social Darwinists did in the struggle for survival. Sometimes we had it in the idea that human rationality was increasing, the purity of it, the extent of it. Sometimes, as John Dewey, we said it wasn't that men were becoming more reasonable, but that they were getting a hold of a scientific method which would make it possible for them to conquer human nature as they had once conquered nature. However the creed was, we didn't worry too much about our perplexities of today because tomorrow would solve them. Now, I think that this is a terrible miscalculation. And that there is a deep note of hysteria in our life. And some of the political hysteria, I think, comes out of these deeper religious levels of hysteria and the sense of meaninglessness, because this is not true. It is true, of course, that there's progress. Even Lucretius, who had a classical conception of history and couldn't really believe in progress but believed in cycles, nevertheless could see and write up in the Nature of Things, in, I think, the fifth chapter, a very good account of man's progress from barbarism to civilization. We know that there is progress in man's conquest of nature. I'm not so sure whether we know that there's progress in philosophy. Professor Brinton has just written a book called Men and Ideas, in which he makes a distinction between the cumulative and non-cumulative forms of human knowledge, which is a very important distinction. Scientists, quite obviously, today, are smarter than Greek scientists, but whether there's any philosopher who's really better than Aristotle is a question. I don't agree with Aristotle, but I mean from the standpoint of philosophical profundity, there probably isn't. There is a difference between cumulative and non-cumulative knowledge. There's one qualification that we probably didn't make either, but at any rate, there certainly is such a thing as progress. There are cumulative effects in history. There isn't any question about that. But certainly there's something very significant, is there not, about the fact that when people were talking about how gradually history would substitute methods of mind for methods of force, we should use mind in order to achieve total wars. What are total wars? They're not wars that the Nazis invented. They are the inevitable consequence of a technical society totally harnessing all human energies in order to achieve what we most deeply desire or to avoid what we most abhor, as we did in fighting the Nazis. That's a total war. We were going to achieve pure methods of mind, where mind was going to meet mind. Now we meet each other totally. We were going to achieve democracy, and we have done very good in democracy, but this has not prevented us or prevented our civilization from achieving the most terrible tyranny. You can almost speak of the history, the progressive history of tyranny. For if you look at the tyranny, let us say, of Henry VIII, this was child's play compared with Hitler or Stalin. All the ancient tyrannies left the hearts of the peasant uncorrupted and didn't pipe their poison by radio into his peasant home. These are the consistencies of progress. There is progress from the arrowhead to the atomic weapon. We become more lethal in our destruction. And while we dreamed of world brotherhood, we get involved in universal wars. These certainly are significant facts. We didn't always look at them. I was sitting with a group of university professors in Eastern University some 2 years ago where we were talking about this. And one natural scientist, a very fine man, said, you know, I had always assumed that scientific development was automatically in favor of human welfare until the atomic bomb came along. And then I suddenly awakened that this was not automatic. And one of his colleagues said, but John, how could you ever have thought that? Didn't you ever recognize the ambiguity of the airplane? That on the one hand it held the nations together, and on the other hand it dumped perdition and destruction upon cities?
and destroyed them in a way that no cities have been destroyed since the days of the Assyrians? Yes, he said, I should have seen it, but I didn't see it until the atomic bomb came along. These are the refutations in our contemporary history, what the contemporary man thinks about life and history. The simple fact is that history is no solution to the human problem. It is the problem. It's bigger all the time. The reason we miscalculate is we may spend a moment on this. It's first of all, we imagine that the increase of human freedom was bound to be in the interest of universality as against particularity and parochialism. It was the ignorant man who was parochial. It was the intelligent man who had universal loyalty. It was the impotent man who stood at this particular spot, but it was the intelligent man who became ubiquitous. Always the universal was the consequence of freedom as against the particular. But the real situation is, of course, that every increase of human freedom